Welcome to the Learning Well podcast, where we take learning seriously, but not ourselves.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Learning Well. We've got an interesting show for you today as we try to wrap our brain around our brain, I guess, or maybe a better way to put it is learning how we learn. So we've got a really knowledgeable guest who's going to help us better understand neuro and cognitive science. I know we've taken a brief foray into that in this podcast before. I'm not sure how well it went. So we decided to bring in the big guns. So today I want to introduce to you Dr. Linda Havman. We've known each other for a long time.
Yes, we have.
When I started to think about a guest, she just came top of mind. And I think as you explain your background, Linda, but she comes from a varied background. And I think for those of you listening, sometimes neuroscience can get very, very clinical, which is important, but we get a little lost in the weeds, or it can be very surfacey, and we're not really getting the information we need. So our goal is to understand how the brain works today and then how we can apply that to learning. So Linda, why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I have a PhD in family and child ecology from Michigan State University. Mm-hmm. I am a licensed therapist, and maybe you didn't know it, but I'm also an ordained pastor, former teacher, professor, academic dean, and now consultant. And I do the whole spectrum from business to how the brain works. And while I have done a lot of research and study in this area, applied it to a number of areas, I want you to know I'm not a medical doctor.
Right.
I'm not a neurosurgeon. So I want to make that disclaimer.
I think you're maybe more qualified as you run down that list. But those qualifications actually were what made me think of you top of mind. So with a background in education and learning, you understand how to take that science and apply it. And then as a licensed therapist, you understand how to help people work through things often related to the brain and emotions. And so I'm really excited. Just in our preparation for this, I felt like I already understood better. So just as a quick preface, though, we have, for those of you maybe listening just in isolation or for the first time to this podcast, we talked about learning science, and what we did was we just did a really brief, maybe 5 minute, on different aspects of learning science, one of which was brain science, neuroscience, cognitive science. And at that time, we got a lot of interest in it. We've since written an ebook and, done some other things. But again, always with that nagging feeling that we weren't getting it all right because we're not experts and that we were just scratching the surface. So today is going to be a little bit deeper dive, but I do want to point our listeners back to a couple other ones if you kind of wanted to put into context why we're specifically focused on brain science today. So Linda, why don't you, where did your interest in the brain first start?
Sure. In the late 1990s, early 2000s, I was an executive director of a before and after school program. Mm-hmm. And back then, Eric Jensen was coming out with some great materials, and I was a member of an early childhood association, and so the brain was big news. And part of that had to do with the diagnosis of President Reagan and his dementia.
Sure.
In the late 1990s, there was a renewed interest in the brain surrounding President Reagan, and that offered great opportunities to learn. And when Eric Jensen did his work, he noticed that back in World War I, they could figure out how the brain was working by where shrapnel went into the brain and how it impacted people.
Right.
I mean, crazy and awful, awful situation, but yet that gave us so many insights. And then in World War II, that continued and it actually increased our knowledge. Hmm. So in around 2004, I left the early childhood and began to work in higher education. So I was switching,
where we met, yeah.
Yes, from pedagogy to andragogy, the adult learning theory. And so even though some of those principles really did apply what I was learning about the brain to the adults, I really had to contextualize it in a better way.
Yep.
And John Medina was fabulous in that for me. And I remember, I think the two of us did a workshop for the faculty members, and I used a lot of John Medina's brain rules material, and I looked recently and he has some updated books, so that interest was really there. And then the mid around 2006, my father had Lewy body, which was a form of dementia. And so then I began to think, okay, how is this going to impact my brain?
Sure,
what can we
right.
do to improve? So it was this process of having an interest, and then around 2010, I actually did a lot of research on neurofeedback and how manipulating, engaging the brain could help heal some of the PTSD that some of our vets were experiencing, and I had some success with that. So,
was that a part of your, like, when you were working on your degree to be a therapist or as a therapist?
Sure,
or?
It was shortly thereafter my degree, and okay. then I had to go to California to be certified and trained and did a lot
oh, okay.
of studying. And then I had a private practice for mm-hmm. a while I was working at the university. And so that love is there. And as I get older, and as I see my grandchildren, and I read books about the scientist in the crib, you know, my interest has peaked. And even though we're learning more things, there are a lot of things that I learned in 1990 that still apply today.
Yeah, I loved when we talked about this, you know, your kind of focus on making this both applicable, but just how it's developed in your life. And, you know, we had a conversation about, I think all of us have different people in our lives where their brain is affected, whether it's a child that has some sort of either, you know, exceptional gifts or maybe some, you know, exceptional struggles at times, whatever those might be, or other people in our lives where their brain is affected. And I think all of us are interested. Did I say that wrong?
No. That was great.
Okay.
That was great.
So I guess maybe some of the largest feedback that we've gotten is, and I know even as I'm saying it, you're looking at me a little bit, like, so I try to say, what's the difference between neuroscience and cognitive science? And that's probably not even really the right way to say it. So can you help our listeners understand there's sort of these two aspects, maybe more, and what's the difference?
Sure. So neuroscience, when we take the beginning, the word neuro really has to do with our nervous system and our nerves. And then science is an actual study of that. And so neuroscience is the study of the brain, whether it's the neurons, the parts of the brain, how they engage with each other, how they work. Where when we think of cognitive science, it's more the study of how we learn, how our emotions are processed,
okay.
and really it's interdisciplinary, that it actually includes neuroscience in it. And so today in some of the books that you might read about cognitive neuroscience.
Okay.
And so it actually comes together.
So we would probably be more accurate if we just started talking about brain science, and
sure.
then these are the various aspects, not necessarily needing to split them into two because they overlap.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Right.
That's really helpful.
So, yeah, Miriam, I have a question for you. When you think about the brain, mm-hmm. when do you have more connections in your brain? When you are born? When you are 3? When you are 8, a teenager, or an adult?
So I would say, I always think of a newborn having like a fresh brain. I think that's just because my brain feels so old and I forget so many things. But if I think of connections, like connectivity to context, to like other situations, I guess I'd probably say as an adult, but that's probably wrong. So I don't know.
I think that's a great guess. And as
she's so, you're so nice.
Well, when you are born with a lot of connections, really the same amount of connections that you have as an adult.
So it stays the same.
Well, it doesn't stay
okay.
the same. There's something that happens actually around age 3. Your connections double or triple.
Wow.
So quite often we hear about the push for early childhood, and you talk about this window of opportunity, and that's all true. But it used to be that we thought, well, if you missed that window of opportunity, it was too late. And that is not the case at all. But we do know that at age 3, those connectors double or triple. And then at age 8, they begin pruning back. So the connectors that are no longer being used are gone away with, so that more connectors can happen again through puberty that starts again. And then as an adult, you make those connectors, and we are constantly growing connectors in our brain. There's always hope, and I think that is really encouraging. So if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about those connections that come from neurons. And I would like you or all of us to look at our arm, our forearm, and we are going to look at the parts of a neuron.
Okay.
Now, first of all, there's 100 billion neuron cells. I can't even imagine how many there are. But if you look at the palm, that would be your cell body.
Okay, yeah.
Your fingers are your dendrites, and those dendrites will reach up to other neurons and make those connectors. So those are really important. So you have your cell body and your dendrites, and then your arm would be what is called the axon.
Okay.
And that is what reaches down to other dendrites to make connections. Now, around that axon, as you are making connections, it develops a myelin sheath, this white goopy stuff that goes around it, and it strengthens it. So as I studied brain information around 2000, and then it came back to in 2005, that connection was made stronger. And now as I look at it in 2022, it's even stronger. So though that sheath is very, very important. And within our brain, we have 500,000 miles of neural roads. Now, if we compare that to the U.S. National Highway System, we have 3 times more roads in our brain than what we do in the U.S. National System.
That is insane. And I wanted to point out for our listeners too, like one thing that we often get is, I've read several books on learning science and the brain, and the biology piece of it is where I get bogged down, maybe just because it's very complicated and I get a little confused. And so one thing that I had asked Linda to do was to break down for us the biology of learning, meaning, so when we talk about these connections, that's how I'm really building more information or more in my brain, I'm creating more knowledge with these connections. So the old axiom when, you know, your parents would say, like, don't just study the night before, don't just cram several nights. So you're increasing that sheath around what you're learning. And is that one of the reasons why? Or
absolutely. Okay. And we're just strengthening that more and more. And in a few minutes, I'll talk about what happens when that sheath is eaten away.
Yeah, that was one of my questions, too. How does that? Okay. Yeah. Well, I will let you keep going.
We have to keep you a bit in suspense. So it is, you know, if we take that arm that we held up and then we bring our other hand and put our fingers to our elbow, that's kind of how a connection is made, just with one finger to my elbow and then up, and then those connections just come over and over again. So
I love the visual. That's great.
Yes, it helps. Then I'm going to loosely talk about the parts of the brain. We can't get into all of
right.
You know, the right, the left, and so forth, but I do think a few of the parts will help. And the first is what we have as the brain stem, and some people call it the lizard brain. It is a part of the body that just continues to work. Your heart pumps, you breathe, you sleep, you wake up.
Okay.
And so if someone is showing that their brain dead, more than likely it's just that lizard brain.
It's the stem part that's not functioning.
Stem is still functioning.
Okay.
And so it controls all of that. It's very important. We need to keep it healthy. But it is one of those parts that they don't do anything as much with the learning process.
Okay. Well, that's helpful actually to understand that. Okay.
So the next part is the limbic system. And this is where so much of the work happens. So we have the amygdala, which is the area where our emotions and memories are generated. And in fact, if you have like an fMRI going on your brain, it's scanning your brain, it will light up when things happen. It is so cool. And when those feelings of goodness happen, your brain will light up and hormones and neurotransmitters are released and it grabs your attention. And as I'm talking, you can hear I'm getting excited.
Yeah, right, absolutely.
And I'm sure my amygdala is just sparking all up and down, you know, very excited of the new things that I'm learning. And that is that short term learning section. It does not do any of the housekeeping, meaning it's not cleaning up, but it is just taking in what you are learning.
So there's implications we'll talk down the road then when we design learning, because if we don't engage that part of that brain, then we're not designing a great, okay, well, I'll let you get to that.
No, you're doing great, because it is that short-term learning that, hey, we have to learn in the short term in order for it to get into the long-term memory.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
And so, you know, the things that you can remember often happen because of an emotion. Mm-hmm. My husband and I will talk about certain events that happen and he'll say, oh, you have such a good memory. And I said, no, I remember because this happened. I was sad, or I was happy, or, you know, I was hungry and my needs were filled. So the amygdala is that area where the short-term brain is bringing in that information. The next area is the hippocampus. And in this part, you are converting your short-term to long-term. Now, I mentioned earlier that my father had Lewy body. It's a form of dementia. And more than likely, it was this part of his brain that was being damaged. The neurons were no longer connecting with each other, and things were dying off. You know, as we've heard the saying, if you don't use it, you lose it. And that is true with the brain. If you do not use it, you are going to lose it. And for myself, I have such a wide variety of interests. Mm-hmm. And I think that's great. It keeps me going. But I also realize I cannot use all of those disciplines all the time.
Right. And you try, so, though. I know you try.
I try to find those things. So go ahead.
Is that why sometimes, you know, it's recommended if you're trying to sort of, you know, as best as you could prevent some form of dementia, like try, you know, continuously learning new things or having outside interests. Again, not that we don't know the solution or we don't have the cure.
Correct.
But is that one of the reasons that's suggested?
Correct.
Okay.
And I believe that is learning the new things, you know, I will see in ARP, it might mention, do crossword puzzles. I can't stand crossword puzzles. However, I might pick up a textbook that person who's doing the crossword puzzle has no interest in. And so I think the key is to learn and to
something
stretch.
New. Okay.
Yes.
Yep.
Yep. Not to stress yourself, but to stretch yourself. So okay. That is the one area. And then the next area is the thalamus, and that really processes all of your senses except for your sense of smell. And so when I think about this limbic system, it is that emotional system. And have you ever heard the phrase, Miriam, out comes your mother?
It's happened. I haven't heard it. It frequently happens.
Well, let me explain how that happens. So we all have things that as we're teenagers, we say to ourselves, we are never, ever going to do this or say that to our children ever again. But when you are put under stress, the brain downshifts right into that limbic system. So you're not in the prefrontal cortex where you're processing and what's the best method. Instead, you're in that emotional things. Instead, you are in that emotional area and out comes your mother or your father. And I have to say, my mother and father taught me a lot of wonderful things, and some of the things that are coming out are probably wise.
Right.
But when you're a teenager,
you don't
want that.
Yeah.
But that does come true too as you are engaging with employees, and as we assume that we are treating everybody as an adult, sometimes supervisors can come down a little heavy-handed as kind of the parent to a child, and that might trigger some of those emotions within that person. And so be careful. You know, you want to relate on that adult to adult level.
Well, and just the effect of stress in general on relationships, you know, in the workplace can cause things, lots of things to happen.
Yeah, absolutely. So next, we talked about that brainstem and then the limbic system. The next area I would like us to think about is that frontal cortex, your forehead area. That is your...
Very interested in that part, yeah.
Yes, and we probably could do one or two podcasts just on this area and how to improve executive functioning. But when children are having a hard time with ADHD, when adults are having a hard time putting their lives together to get their work done, to make the wise choices, it's that prefrontal cortex that is the difference. And we heard way back in the 1800s, there was a young man by the name of Phineas Gage, and he was a railroad worker, and he was a wonderful man. I believe he was a loving father. The community loved him. And one day there was a horrific accident. A 3-foot rod went through the front of his brain in that prefrontal cortex.
Ugh.
He survived.
Wow.
But he was no longer the Phineas Gage that everybody knew and loved. That executive function broke down. And he was no longer able to respond in ways in which he should have. Sometimes I think about this as you get older, and I'm sure it's way off for us, 20 to 30
right,
years,
sure.
I'm sure, maybe 40. You lose that filter, and that is part of it. Our prefrontal cortex is no longer working as it should. So it is a very important part.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Is that where we learned some of the science behind when that accident happened?
Yes.
So that's one of the studies, like his change in behavior was how we learned.
Yes. Okay. So it even broke apart the hemispheres.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, similar to World War I with the shrapnel and World War II, we do learn through the damage that people have experienced. And certainly we don't want people to do research in a poor manner. We want them to do it in a helpful manner, but we do learn from those tragedies.
Yeah, I did not expect this podcast to have a dark turn, but you know, you're right. Like, it's very interesting how we have learned some of these things.
Yeah. So then just two other parts are the white matter, and that is over that limbic system and other areas, and it's white because you see a lot of those myelin sheaths that are around your axon. That is insulating everything, and that color is right there, and so it looks white.
Okay, so it's all of them together.
Yes.
But it's creating that white.
Kind of crunched all together in a small spot.
Okay.
And then the final is the cerebral cortex, and quite often we call it the gray matter, and that is because all of the cell bodies, remember the palm of your hand, they're kind of toward the top, and it just shows off a little bit of a gray look.
Okay.
Now that cerebral cortex is all folded, so if you were able to take it out and unfold it, it would be about the size of a small baby blanket.
Oh, wow.
And its thickness could be almost as big as a heavy-duty cardboard.
Huh.
So some people have more of a hard head than others.
Yeah, that's true. That's so interesting.
And thankfully, I don't have it written down here, but I've heard it's not head size that makes a difference with how much brain power you have. And that was comforting because I have a very small head.
Interesting.
That was just a brief review from that lizard brain all the way to the limbic system, the prefrontal cortex, and then our white matter and cerebral cortex.
Well, and I don't think that was a review for most of us. It certainly wasn't for me, but I mean, I feel like I have 100 questions now. But it's really good to help me sort of break down what each part of the brain did, because that was always a little bit of a loss for me. Especially when I think about learning, like what parts of the brain are more important when I'm considering learning. I mean, it all is important, but you can see by your explanation, we can sort of better understand what's more important. So let's maybe think about learning a little bit now that we kind of understand better how our brain works. How do we relate that to learning?
Yeah, so there are a number of things that we can cover. And first of all, as we're thinking about working with our employees, 70% of their learning is hands-on. And I'm sure, Miriam, as you've worked with employees, it's one thing to give them a sheet of paper, a job aid, and say, okay, here, follow the directions and go through it. Some people, that will work, but I would say it's few and far between. Most people need to have somebody come alongside of them and work on it. So about 70% hands-on learning. Then about 20% social learning. So you do need to learn in community. Mm-hmm. And then only 10% informal education. All right, education's been a part of my background.
Right,
so
right.
What is that saying? All of this work that I've done over the years, it still is 10%.
It is important.
And it is very important because there you have to make time that you are literally walking people through the steps and the knowledge. So I do have a staff person who just says, I just want to walk through this and I'm going to manipulate the computer as we do it. But there are some things that I do need to sit back and say, okay, do you know about what this means and what that means? And just giving those details. So it's 10%, but make time for it. It's important.
Well, and I, you know, too, we deal with that a lot because a lot of the work we do is digital learning. But we've spent a long time climbing on our soapbox, you know, working with our clients, helping them understand what kinds of content are best suited for, you know, an e-learning experience. And it's typically sort of that knowledge, that 10%,
yes.
Before we then, you know, if you're in a manufacturing situation, head out to the floor, or we can get at some of it if we're designing really good scenarios that are forcing people to think through why and when and how. But there's very real science behind that. But I think just our kind of everyday life, like our gut tells us that too.
Right.
I can read it, I can talk to somebody about it, but until I do it myself, I just don't know it very well.
Well, and that was one reason why the work that I'm currently doing, I develop rapid learning modules. Mm-hmm. And they're under 5 minutes in length. They're able to take 1 to 2 strategies, immediately apply it to they're working in jails right now. Mm-hmm. So that's where they're applying it. And I know I can walk through all the steps of how to do a death notification, how to sit down, do a small group. But all of a sudden, it's time to do it.
Right.
What do I do?
Right.
And so I want to make sure that I have that 10% ready and available and easily found.
Yes.
So that they can go through that. So, but there are stages as well to our memories. And I am wondering, Miriam, do you multitask?
More than I would like to admit to, because I know it doesn't really work that way. So, yeah, I find it very interesting. I mean, I used to be able to just sit for hours and research or write, and now I find myself very distracted. I don't think my attention span, at least most science says my attention span hasn't necessarily changed, but the distractions have.
Yes.
So I actually have to consciously work at, nope, I'm going to set aside this time. I'm, you know, shut everything down, whatever it is, and just really focus. I almost have to retrain my brain.
The visual I always used, especially when I was working on my dissertation, is I would pretend I was putting on a seatbelt and putting myself in the chair and just doing it. But back when I did the work with John Medina in the early 2000s, and he talked about multitasking, and really what happens is you create more errors.
For sure, yeah.
And so I'm thinking, oh my, I always have a number of projects going on. I must be just making all kinds of mistakes. Well, there's a difference in chunking your learning.
Mm-hmm.
And you still might call it multitasking because you start out working on this. So for instance, today I was reviewing the information for the podcast. I was then going on to some sort of an assessment for our programs. So they were all separated. So they were kind of chunked, they were spaced, and those are things that you can do, and it is good. So if you are a person who likes to do a variety of things, it's good. Just make sure you kind of put your seatbelt on, stay in the groove, and stay in that mood. So as you are learning your memory, you first have to encode. You need to have the attention, take in the information, then you have to store it. And then the key is to retrieve. And that's what we so often do with our employees, is that we might give them all this information, but we're not asking them to utilize it. And we find that quite often in our quarterly meetings that we send them away, okay, chaplains, go and do this and this, but unless they actually have a task to do it, they're going to lose it.
Well, and that's why we spend so much time talking about learning is not a one-time event. So you can, you know, you're, like you said, providing the information, checking the box. No, like you need to revisit it. The current industry buzzword is like a nudge. Oh. I don't know if I quite call it that, but you know, in 2 weeks, the check of how have you applied it, in what ways have your behavior changed, and then in a month. And then maybe it's time now for some additional information that's added to this. And you know, it should be a never ending, I don't say cycle, but it's very, you know, we're continually building upon that. Otherwise, we do forget it.
Well, and that so ties in nicely with the chunking, because as you are presenting information, you want to build on what the person already knows. And when we were working in higher education in the adult learning world, we knew we had to apply it to, we had to realize that they were experts in their areas.
Situation.
Whether it was psychology or business or Bible, they had some experience. And unless you tap into that previous knowledge, it's not going to stick either.
Right.
So you need to hook in some shape or fashion. And then the other interesting part is, well, let me ask you a question.
Okay.
What do you like about TED Talks? Or don't you like TED Talks?
I don't listen to a ton of them.
Okay.
If I hear, I think when they became so prevalent, I was like, well, now they're just a dime a dozen. I don't really care anymore. They're
okay.
Not that special. I guess I would say if I, you know, if there was like some key ones, they are, I love the fact that they're very professional. I'm not great with people stumbling around. I get like social anxiety for them.
Yes, I agree.
So I love that they're professionally and they get right to the point and they have like their 5 key points and they're done.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So the interesting thing that I picked up from them is that their speed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They move along. And from what I understand, they might have a few props that they're using.
Sometimes,
I don't know.
Yeah, sometimes,
I don't know. But it is definitely the speed. So not only do we have to chunk it, connecting it to previous knowledge, we also have to be aware of our speech. Mm-hmm. Because our mind is able to process about 500 words a minute. And if you have someone who speaks quite slowly, your brain is going to wander.
Mm-hmm.
You might enjoy this relaxed environment, but you're enjoying being relaxed and not necessarily learning. So therefore, make sure that your speech is at a good pace, not too fast, and you need to have breaks. I know when I used to, especially when I started preaching for the first few times, my husband would tell me, you have so much to say. Take a break.
Right, take a break. Yes, I could give several examples. I will say, in the work that we do, like the metric we use is about 100 words a minute.
Okay.
When we're trying to figure out length. So we're developing some kind of e-learning module, and we want to, everybody always wants to know, how long will it be? Well, we have to, you know, we write the script, we figure out, but we discovered it's really probably closer to 125, but it varies depending on the complexity. So if it's a really complex topic, you have to slow down a little bit to let
Absolutely.
People process. So that's interesting.
So, and I think the key takeaway here is that your speed relates well to what you're doing,
yes.
Whether it's going to be the details that you need to get out or it's just an overview, it's going to make a difference. The other thing has to do with spacing of how you learn, and this I relate well to the multitasking as well.
Okay.
And this research is back from the 1800s that
it's
they
so
started.
Funny. Yeah, there's nothing new. I mean, there is new, but this is, it's very interesting.
Yes, and so going back to what you said at the beginning about the cramming, no. Don't do it.
Right.
And for some odd reason, even when I was in high school, I knew if I had a test coming up, I needed to study 2 or 3 nights ahead of time. I don't know why, but that's what worked for me. And then later, the brain sciences taught me that that's exactly what you need. And some of the things that I'm sure you've read is that if you study before you go to sleep, then as you are sleeping, your brain is processing and even creating new memories, but that will help.
Hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other thing is if you have a lot to do, do your work, similar to how we talked about multitasking, and then go to a different topic and work on that. And that kind of gives your brain a break, and then come back, so that spacing will make a solid positive impact in your learning.
So not the crazy multitasking of like every 2 minutes I'm switching to something else and checking email and all of that. But, and I will say, we, as we grew as a company, we discovered that people who used to have the whole day to work on projects now were interrupted 5 times by meetings. And we had to go back to the, nope, everybody gets 3 hours or 2 hours to, like you said, that chunking of time to really focus, because it takes a while to get into things.
Right.
And then there's certain times that we're, but I would just, you know, for our listeners, like, our days sometimes are out of our control, but sometimes we need to take back that control, because your brain isn't happy. And that's why we feel stressed. And that's why we also don't do great work sometimes.
Well, and in that way, I'm very happy I have a printer that's outside of my office.
Oh, sure.
Because I think there are times that you just simply need to get up and walk. And I've always wondered what it would be like if I could bring treadmill or something into my office and work as I'm doing some things. I've never been that daring, but it is something that I think would make a difference. So, you know, if you are feeling stuck, stand up and go to the bathroom, get a drink of water, whatever it might mean. I think about the old adage of the water cooler, and I think in some ways that helped. And even as I worked at home during the COVID season, I wasn't taking the breaks that I needed to take. And I do think that that is really important, that now that I'm back in the office, I do get a few more interruptions with engaging with other people. Mm-hmm. So, and then I also strongly encourage that you make use of job aids. And for this webcast, I did, our podcast, I did put together a job aid that Miriam, you can certainly distribute, that will kind of highlight an outline of what we've discussed in some of my favorite books.
That'd be great.
That I've
Thank
used.
You.
So, and that relates to the rapid learning that I do for my chaplains. They will have that 5 minute segment, sometimes two, sometimes seven. And then there's also a job aid, because I realize that there are people who, they do need the paper in front of them, as well as being able to see it. So making use of those are very good. And then I loved how you talked about in the industry how you are doing those nudges, because it is so important for retention that you do come back to that. And you can do that through sending an email, a question of the day, anything that gets people thinking back. And to be honest, I've done a lot of training on trauma, and I'm saddened at myself that I haven't gone back to the people that I've trained and asked them some questions, just to pique their interest, to get in gear into what they're doing. But it is so important.
Yeah, but I think that's a very real reality of our industry. There's always a fire to be put out.
Yes.
There's always, you know, so we make it, we drop it on people, and we run away because we're headed to the next whatever it is. So, but I think our industry is recognizing more and more with this emphasis on learning science and like how important it is. So I'm definitely seeing an upward trend in whatever it is, you know, not just pre-work and post-work, but continuing nudges and adding to it. And so I'm excited about the way that the industry is going.
Yeah.
Well, this has been really, really helpful, Linda. And I, as you said, I think we could probably go on and have two or three more podcasts after this. But something that I think has maybe become a little more top of mind to people, whether it's COVID, whether it's people working in different environments, still many people from home. How does your neuro design really impact, like, the way that your brain works? What are the implications, you know, if for health and safety in the workplace, and what can we do to really promote, I think, like that brain health in the workplace?
Yeah, and there are some things that we might not have considered, but really having a green space. I do not have a green thumb, but I am trying. And if you can have plants, flowers, whatever it is going to give you better health for your body, plus it is going to relax you. So even if you can have your employees looking outside at different times, maybe they don't have a window in their office, but they can go to another part of the building and look outside at the green grass, it's going to make a big difference for them.
I love that. And that's pretty, I mean, unless you have very specific reasons why, like anyone can bring in a plant. It's not a terribly difficult thing to do. You might not keep it alive, but you can keep trying.
Yes. So. Yes. And that perseverance is going to make a difference too.
Right.
So the other thing is really the color of your walls. And right now we are in a room that is kind of greenish blue. So it's kind of a combination. But green does bring a bit of serenity and it does allow you to focus, where blue makes you a little more hypervigilant, not like a red.
Right.
But if you have some of the lighter greens, that would be a good color for your working space. So consider the colors.
Yeah.
And for that reason, the blue colors too, at night on your phone and that type of stuff, it can just become so distracting, keep you from your good sleep. But the other thing, and I think it was John Medina who pointed this out, is the size of the room.
Oh, in what way?
So if you are gathering your team together and you are trying to do some brainstorming, some big picture, some strategic development, a much larger room would be your go-to place.
Really?
In fact, something with cathedral ceilings would be better. Something big, it just kind of opens up your mind. But if you need to get into the nitty-gritty, a smaller room with lower ceilings.
Interesting. Maybe that's why, like, if you're stuck in a cubicle, you feel like you never have a big idea.
That could very well be.
Interesting. So, okay.
Those are just the few things that I have that I think our audience would find helpful.
Well, I so appreciate you just unpacking. I mean, this is a lot, and it's difficult to do. I don't know if our listeners understand how much time you put in to provide, like, a visual understanding, because this is just audio. But yet to be able to picture what the brain looks like and the various parts your expertise in teaching has come out too. Aww. So
it was certainly a joy to get back together with you, Miriam.
Yeah, no, this has been really good. I do want to ask you before you go though, and our listeners want to know too. We always ask, what are you learning well now? And given who you are, I'm sure it was hard to decide, but I'd love to hear, what are you learning well now?
Well, currently most of my time spent working is with Reach the Forgotten Jail Ministry, and you can find us at jailministry.org. And right now we have 34 county chaplains across the state of Michigan going into our jails. And what we are finding is that 97% of our inmates have been traumatized.
Yeah, sure.
And oftentimes we need to help them with that trauma before they can become the people with whom they've been created to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we've been doing some research with that. I've been hosting some Healing the Wounded Heart trainings for our chaplains and for our volunteers, and just trying to find ways that we can improve society so that our inmates stop coming back.
Right. No, I mean, in that. What a perfect fit for you, because with your understanding of brain science, all of that really plays into, I'm sure, your ability to teach about trauma. And I think such a meaningful job.
Yes, so, very much so.
So, and I noticed that you had, like you said, you've listed for our listeners in our show notes. Mm-hmm. We will put some of the books, we will put the job aid, and we'll probably release the job aid on social media too.
Yep, perfect.
Thank you so much. And I just want to thank our listeners too. So if you are looking to interact more with us, you can find our posts on MindSpring's Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn anytime we release a new podcast. But thank you all for listening. We know your time is a gift, and we thank you for choosing to spend it with us.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Learning Well podcast. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please leave some feedback on whatever platform you're streaming on. We'd really appreciate it. We'll see you in the next episode.